Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it is all about constitutional compliance. And this is one of the reasons why we go through all of these our primary source documents that created or document how we evolved into this government and what every line of the Constitution means. There's no better education. You can't get this kind of education from Hillsdale. You can't get this kind of education from any college because they have redefined and redefined and redefined the existing government so that when you go to their courses, they're not going to stand up and tell you everything you're looking at is wrong. They're not going to do it because they are accountable to the money they receive from the federal government. Because the federal government happens to be piping. Now, there may be some private schools out there, but they still won't rock the boat. And that is an indictment of where we are as a society. Now, we are in the throes of the convention, and let me, because I think I haven't said this in a couple episodes, and forgive me for not, please, if you are in a good habit of praying regularly, please, you know, pray, learn, act. As you pray, you know, seek the Spirit so that you can understand what you need to understand as dictates by the Spirit, so that we can understand what we need to pray for, what we need to do when we act, and so forth. I am here to tell you the adage of Edmund Burke, and the only thing for evil to succeed is for good, and I'm going to just change it, good righteous people to do nothing. All we have to do is take a stand, folks. We don't need a majority. You don't have to say, well, we can't get everybody, so I'm not going to do it. You know, what's the point of me doing it if we can't get everybody to do it? We don't need everybody. We need you. Let's start with you. Why not you? If not you, then who? And if not now, then when? And there we go. So my formal eye-poking session for the month has been done. And anyway, welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean. And we are literally wrapping up. We're looking at September 11th. Is it not ironic that September 11th is the day the convention took a pause? Literally, that's exactly what they said, or that what they ended up doing, because the report of the Committee of Style and Arrangement not being made and being waited for. So in other words, they're waiting on the actual form of the Constitution to come into their hands. The Committee of Style and Arrangement is literally working on and conforming everything into a logical package. And therefore, on Wednesday, September 12th, having in hand a fresh copy of the Constitution in its style and form that we see today, with very minor changes from this point on. Very minor, but there's still changes that will be injected. And we're going to talk, and those changes we're going to talk about. So Dr. Johnson, and we're not talking about, you know, the Dr. Johnson of today. So, you know, let's get that right. And so Dr. Johnson goes through and basically reads the Constitution from Article 1 all the way through, I believe he goes all the way through Article 7. And actually, no, it's in Article 4 where he reads through, and I have it highlighted. This isn't debate. This is the final language of the Constitution. The question is, will there be any further debate to say, I'm not happy with this? So in other words, however we saw the language and however they debated it, there had been another and more changes, minute changes, but this right here is the final language as being presented to the convention. And so, Tammy, if you wouldn't mind, and by the way, welcome back. Go ahead and just read the admission of new states, and you should find that on, well, mine says 446, so I'm going to say 444. It's in red.
Bottom of 443.
Ah, on 443.
Okay. Section 3. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of Congress, as well as of the Congress. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state.
Okay, so do you see anywhere in there where they have the ability, because what they talk about in the second paragraph, that the Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. In other words, forts, magazines, those enumerated objects that are property under the control of the federal government. They have to be granted to them. They can't just assume. Now, they're talking about territory. So while the territory is being developed and being prepared to become a state, they have the authority based on this right here to make needful rules and regulations respecting that territory. That's it. So once the state, is there anywhere in here in the forming of the state? Because remember, the language was before that Congress shall have the power to regulate their apportionment, to regulate their representation, to regulate, you know, their sovereignty, equal footing or anything. So in other words, they didn't create redundancy. As a matter of fact, they wanted to make sure they used as little language as possible so that it wouldn't create any confusion. So that when we notice that the states are being admitted, what powers are given to the Congress to be able to determine the outcome of the states? In other words, as the state is being admitted, do they have any influence on their form of government, on their form of labor, on their, you know, their involvement in religion, the representation, anything regarding the forming of that state and the forming of that constitution? Any power whatsoever?
No.
Thank you. Folks, the fact is that in 1819, when Congress decided to manipulate Indiana into setting aside right, wrong, or indifferent, they had no authority. It was up to Indiana to determine if it was going to and where it was going to determine, you know, any type of education, schools. In those days, schools didn't mean, you know, elementary schools and junior high and so forth, and high school and advanced schools. Schools that they were talking about were higher education, colleges, universities. Everybody was basically homeschooled back in those days. Or they were schooled by, you know, by contract, what have you. Nevertheless, the federal government had no authority to manipulate and to dictate what they had to do with their state or resources within their state. It's one thing to kind of mention, we're going to have, you know, we're going to be buying your salt out of your salt mines, you know, but for them to tell them that they can't do anything with that is contrary. They would need an amendment to the Constitution, and recognizing the fact that Thomas Jefferson in 1803 recommended an amendment to the Constitution so they could do those kinds of things. But they decided not to do it. They just decided to assume powers instead of actually going and getting them. Because life's easier when you can make it up as you go along than it is to be, oh, okay, we're going to make a change, and shoot, we didn't get everything we wanted. We need this now because we didn't know we were going to need this. Well, it's a lot easier to just, you know, dynamically take when you can do that. Well, technically, they don't have the authority to do that. But, folks, that's what they've been doing. So as we look at this language, and this being what I would say the final language of the Constitution, then, and I want to verify this, so let me just pull up my copy of Article 4, Section 3, and this is what it says. New states may be admitted. It kind of looks the same, but let me just get to the same font size. Well, that language right there in that second clause is identical. In other words, the Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and other properties belonging to the United States. And that's it. And nothing in this Constitution. So, Sean, do you remember that second line? And nothing in this Constitution as to prejudice any claims of the United States or any particular state. In other words, that land that was going to be a part of that claim. In other words, that particular clause was pointing to the reference of land, i.e. Kentucky, Tennessee, as well as New Hampshire, to make sure, or New Hampshire and Vermont, to make sure that these states that already had been developing and nurturing these territories on their own, that was their claim. But they would have the power to admit them into the Union. The question was, out of that claim, was Virginia just going to get bigger? Or was Virginia going to allow Kentucky to form out of it? And Virginia decided to allow Kentucky to be admitted as a separate state. The same thing with Tennessee. The same thing with Vermont. So, and it started with Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee in that order. So the next one that we get to as we go down, because this is in Article 4, Section 3. We don't have to go much further down. And we notice that there's an amendment protection clause that's been added to Article 5 that was already, as a matter of fact, Sean, you were the one that read it yesterday. You were the one that actually put the language in here for this particular clause at the end of the amendment protection clause. So go ahead, Sean, and just go ahead and read what that language is. Very short.
Under admission of new states?
No. If you go down, scroll down to...
Okay.
There's a small clause. Little yellow clause right there in Article 5.
Provided that no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the blank and blank section of blank article.
Okay, so at this point they had firm because it was 4 and 5. Remember, it was sections 4 and 5 of a specific article. They hadn't changed that until later. And so this does not include, do you see any language in here including the states losing their suffrage? No. In other words, this was moving forward without any protection for the state suffrage in the Senate. And I believe that the fact that they added this, the little state started thinking, hey, you know what? One of our greatest fears is us losing our suffrage and our sovereignty. If we lose our suffrage in the Senate, we lose our sovereignty. Therefore, let's make an amendment protection clause. And so at this point in time, the epiphany hadn't occurred. That's the only reason I'm pointing these two things out. Is that the admission of the states was now locked down, that Congress had no power over the authority, representation, the forming of government, the forming of the Congress, no power to manipulate how that state was to form. They had full discretion and full determination in determining whether they'd be a free state or not. In other words, this concept of full determination, just like every human being should have full determination based on the information they receive to make the decisions for themselves and to choose and to, you know, make a mistake. And if you're going to make a mistake, go out with a bang. At least that's the Darwin theory, I think, something like that. But anyway, bad humor. Okay, nobody's laughing there, so I'll just move on. So we go down a little bit further, and I'm trying to find the next spot. And here it is, and this happens to deal with the militia. And this is on September 14th. It starts off with the militia. And this is probably 455 on your pages. It's 458 on mine. It's in blue. Okay, so go ahead and read Mason, and then I'll have Sean read Madison and back and forth.
Colonel Mason, being sensible that an absolute prohibition of standing armies in time of peace might be unsafe, and wishing at the same time to insert something pointing out and guarding against the danger of them, moved to preface the clause, Article 1, Section 8, quote, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, etc., with the words, and that the liberties of the people may be better secured against the danger of standing armies in time of peace, end quote. Mr. Randolph seconded the motion.
Okay, so then Mr. Madison replied.
Mr. Madison was in favor of it. It did not restrain Congress from establishing a military force in time of peace if found necessary. And as armies in time of peace are allowed on all hands to be an evil, it is well to discountenance them by the Constitution, as far as will consist with the essential power of the government on that head.
Okay, so Mr. Governor Morris opposed the motion as setting a dishonorable mark of distinction on the military class of citizens. And so Mr. Pinckney and Bedford occurred in the opposition, and so on the question whether they were going to admit or put in what Mason asked for, New Hampshire was no, Massachusetts was no, Connecticut was no, New Jersey was no, Pennsylvania was no, Delaware was no, Maryland was no, Virginia, yes, North Carolina, no, South Carolina, no, and Georgia, yes. Wow. So it went down in flames 2-9. So Colonel Mason then moved. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason moved to strike out from the clause, Article 1, Section 9, quote, no bill of attainder, nor any ex post facto law shall be passed. The words, nor any ex post facto law. He thought it not sufficiently clear that the prohibition meant by this phrase was limited to cases of criminal nature, and no legislature ever did or can altogether avoid them in civil cases.
Okay, so Mr. Gary seconded it, and so on the question, all the states were no. So go ahead and read the last part of this blue, Sean. Thanks.
Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Gary moved to insert a declaration that the liberty of the press should be inviolably observed. Mr. Sherman said that it is unnecessary. The power of Congress does not extend to the press. On the question, it passed in the negative.
Okay, so we could go through the votes, but there's just a couple states that said yes, and everybody said, are you kidding? The fact of the matter is, this right here was not a hoodwink. This right here was a resolve and a reminder that the federal government had to have the object enumerated. In other words, you had to list that power over the press, or power to be involved in the press, power to be involved in speech, for the federal government to be involved in it. If it's not listed, they can't meddle with it, which is why Mr. Sherman said, there's no reason for this. Now, the reason why they wanted to make sure the ex post facto and a bills of attainder was because state legislatures, or legislatures period, have a tendency to become oppressive. And those were two types of things that they wanted to make sure that the federal government, because you may actually have power over property, and then eventually come up with a regulation that says, if you don't have a water well on your property, you can't have a water well. And that right there has been passed throughout the Union in the last couple of decades, at a very rampant speed. There's many of the western and central states that are now, the land has become literally marked as useless, because who would buy property if they can't put a well there? if you don't have running water, the cost of running water all the way from the city, way out hundreds of miles to these, you know, these agricultural areas, is absolutely ridiculous. Or the cost of engineering the redirection of water through canals and so forth becomes insurmountable. There's no way these states could develop their agriculture that way. But all you have to do is give the farmer the ability to tap into the water aquifer, the well underneath them, and now they can make that land productive. Why would a state do that other than to tie its hands and to force the state to become more dependent on agricultural products outside of the state and outside of the union, which is why the globalist agenda has gone down this path and why we see a lot of farmland being abandoned because they don't allow you to put a well on property anymore. At least out there in the Netherlands, I call it the hinterland, but anyway. So let's move forward. Because when you really look at the restrictions were very specific that they thought it was necessary to add. One of the things that we're going to go through when we hit the ratification debates is the coins and currency of gold and silver, because the states vehemently speak out against this, and this is where we learn all of the folly and the evils of the states and how they were manipulating their own currencies. And how the only way to get away from that was to have a solid, fixed gold and silver. Now, we're supposed to have gold, based on the act of gold and silver that was first passed, there was supposed to be a standard that they weren't to diminish the gold coin beyond a certain impurity, or silver. And yet, look at the dollar today, the quarter, the dime, and the impurities that are within those silver coins. There's been no change in the Constitution and the requirement of that purity standard other than they arbitrarily decided not to follow it so that they could stretch our currency a little bit further and a little bit further. And this has been done over millennia of different governments and how they've stolen the wealth from the people by adding alloys and other metals to their gold, to their silver, so that they can, you know, profit for themselves because they keep the pure gold and they give you the lead mixed gold and so forth. So anyway, and we'll get through this in the ratification base, which is just around the corner, my friends, just around the corner. So we're moving forward, and now we're going to hit this next Amendment Protection Clause. And the next Amendment Protection Clause is on September 15th. 2 days before the Constitution signed. And it is on page 465, which I'm going to guess is 462, maybe? Probably, something like that?
Correct, sir.
Okay, so now we actually see, and this is where it's debated on the state legislature suffrage and so forth, this is where they add this. So, in other words, it was a couple of days later the small states finally had this epiphany. Hey, you know, they added this clause in protecting, you know, the ending of the slave trade and to ensure that there would be no change in the sentiments just because they end the slave trade. That doesn't mean that they, you know, actually, the whole point of the 1808 clause was to end the slave trade. And they wanted to make sure that there would be no amendment that would pass to change that, to speed it up, or to end it more rapidly. So we're going into break real quick. And so as of such, we're going to dive into this one section here where they go through the Amendment Protection Clause. Now, folks, I'm going to ask you to go Google Amendment Protection Clause. And technically, that's exactly what these clauses are. These are clauses in Article 5 that protect the Constitution from any amendment being made to make these types of changes. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so folks, you had a little bit of time to actually go and Google, quote, Amendment Protection Clause, close quote. And I'll bet you that those of you who actually looked this up was a bit surprised. And I'm going to guess that, Sean, maybe you were surprised. And, I'm sorry, Sean. You're not muted anymore. Tammy, are you surprised? Did you try to Google Amendment Protection Clause?
I can't find anything.
That's fine. So, Sean, did you go off and Google that?
It doesn't show up.
Okay. So, but actually, if you put it in Google, you'll actually get AI that'll come and tell you what it thinks you're asking for. Sean,
Yeah, so it takes me to, it thinks I'm asking for the 14th Amendment.
Correct. Okay, so let's take a real quick pause here. First off, let's decide what you would call this. If you're a law professor or anybody involved in law and understand the, what we call, the Necessary and Proper Clause, because they just use the names Necessary and Proper, or the Supremacy Clause, or the General Defense and Welfare Clause. And so it's because that's what those clauses kind of start with. But if there's, when we look at this, we look at the Article 5. Article 5 is the amendment article. This is where changes to the Constitution and how changes can be done. But to everybody's surprise, there are two lines in here, actually almost four lines, that say you can't make amendments like these two. These two types of amendments cannot be amended to the Constitution. What would you call that?
In contract law, an amendment clause controls how modifications to the agreement are made, typically requiring changes to be in writing and signed by the authorized parties.
Yeah, but when you create a clause that prohibits you from any type of amendment of this nature, what would you call that? I mean, I'm giving you what the language would be. We're prohibiting you from making any amendment to this contract that have, the nature of this and this and this. In other words, creating a listing of amendments that you can't make. What would you call that? Now, I've called it because...
Restriction?
I call it the Amendment Protection Clause. In other words, the Constitution is protected from these types of amendments, where the parties to the compact wanted to protect themselves from these types of amendments ever being admitted down the road. So they wanted to basically stake their claim. You can't make these changes. Even if you think it's fitting to do, you can't change these two things, because there's two things in here. There's two clauses that restrict the states from being able to amend these changes or take changes out of the Constitution that would affect these two things. So I've called it the Amendment Protection Clause. But interestingly enough, and to me that's just plain language. Interestingly enough, when you look at what you call this, there's no name for this. Constitutional lawyers don't talk about this. You know why?
No.
Because the 17th Amendment has been perceived, the 17th Amendment has been perceived to change and take away the suffrage. Even though it didn't, it never did, most people don't know that the suffrage was guaranteed in the Constitution. Ergo, the 17th Amendment changed it. They don't even know it's there. By identifying, had the 17th Amendment pointed to this, it would have caused pause by a lot of the other states to go, hold on, I didn't know this was here. So why did the framers include this clause that said no state shall lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent? What does this mean? Why did they do this? Oh, well, and they look at the 17th Amendment. Well, that's not actually doing that. And moving forward, they would have basically said, okay, we're changing the mechanism of how senators are chosen, but the state legislatures still have full control over them. They wanted, because of the ignorance of the people at the time, people not reading and not learning the Constitution, ergo the framers, by basically allowing the legal system to abscond the curriculum and tell you what they want you to know and look at what they want you to look at, these clauses have been completely obviated. I talk to lawyers all the time, and it's this learning. I didn't even know that existed. I never even heard of that. And when I tell them the Amendment Protection Clause, they go, there's no such thing. And I go, read Article 5. And what do you call that? And for a lack of, you know, because you kind of pollute the water when you tell them what it is. All of a sudden, they think in that paradigm. So it's hard for them to come up with maybe a more accurate depiction of it. But this is where this could have easily been added to Article 1, Section 9 or 10. But they wanted to make sure that they tied it to the amendments so that no amendment, because this is where the amendment process is galvanized. This is how you amend the Constitution. However, you cannot amend it to do these two things. So the whole point here, folks, is that there is this thing in the Constitution that is this, you know, very dark recessed point of gold that helps us understand. This actually helps prove this concept of what the framers were really struggling over in the Constitutional Convention. GR has been telling you from the beginning that this slavery issue and the state's suffrage in the Senate, their sovereignty, was all contingent upon these two paradigms. And ergo, at least the state sovereignty was contingent upon the paradigm of their suffrage in the Senate, and the need of the slave trade and the compromise of basically ending it in 1808 so that the slave trade would then have to be managed by themselves. So in other words, everybody would have to start either, you know, creating a mechanism of growing slaves. In other words, you know, and I hate to even go down that path. I hate to even talk about, you know, creating, you know, breeding companies where they could breed slaves. But that's what they were going to be forced to do. And there was, and if you think about this, and I'm just trying to look at this really pragmatically. Sean, tell me if this makes sense. Tammy, tell me if this makes sense. It would be in your advantage if you're a large franchise to basically keep in-house the slaves you produce for yourselves because you're looking to expand into the new territories by your families and so forth, you know, and other investors that want to become a part of your plantation works. And so as you are expanding, you would be basically taking care of yourself. It would not do you any advantage other than by the, you know, the gain of selling a young man or a young woman as a slave, you know, for the immediate, because you have a surplus. But to manage that, to make sure that you don't have a surplus, is more of an advantage for yourself than not. Is that not correct? Or do you see that as, I mean, this is a repugnant conversation,
yeah, sure.
but so go ahead, Tammy. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I said, yeah, for sure.
Okay. John, your thoughts.
Well, I think you're right in that.
Right. So in other words, slavery was going to continue, but what happened was it gave these large plantation owners, this was their downfall, by the way, if you really think about it, because they became selfish and the self-serving in, you know, controlling the growth of their slaves for themselves only. It made it harder and harder. Once you got into these new states, this is the outcome of what happened in Missouri, really backlashed on them, which is why they needed to have a direct violation of the Constitution. And that violation was the Missouri Compromise, because there was no way Missouri was going to become a slave state. There was only a few slave plantations, you know, developments in Missouri. Most of those people were freeholders doing their own thing. They didn't want to see slavery. This is why the big lie and the big deception has been basically trying to help everybody. Oh, well, Missouri wanted. No, the people that the majority of the money wanted slavery. The majority of the people didn't. And so slavery was basically inflicted upon that state. And so if you want to try to prove me otherwise, by all means, I'd love somebody to actually go through this, because what will end up happening is they'll dig up the documents, which if they are able to come up with an argument that can refute me, then I'll bet you I will find the source documents that would actually substantiate this. Because it was not natural for people that were getting into agriculture to want to have slaves. If you were growing cotton, maybe so, because we already had that conversation regarding the cotton gin. But Missouri was not a cotton state. Missouri was really more of an agriculture food belt state. You know, when you're getting into the drier south and so forth, that's where you find the cotton fields where you have a much drier season. Now, I don't know. So how much cotton fields were down in Louisiana that you guys have today? Do you guys have cotton fields in Louisiana?
There's some.
There's some.
I'm sure it's not it prevalent as it was.
You know where you can still find cotton fields today?
Mississippi.
Okay. Interesting. That's I wouldn't have thought that. But I do know that when I drive through Maryland, and especially when I drive through Delaware, you do see cotton fields out there. In the Delmarva area. And so, anyway, what we were seeing in Iowa and in Missouri and so forth, they were growing, you know, it was livestock. It was just a variety of food, because it was just so rich. You know, the fertility or the soil was just so, that's the Mississippi Delta. It was just rich soil. And so cotton actually grows pretty easy on kind of dry and arid land, like you see on sandy land like Delmarva. Delmarva doesn't have, I don't think, nearly the same kind of nutrients that you would find in the Mississippi Delta. So, but there's still a market out there, because are we still using cotton? Of course we are. But back in those days, I think that those who wanted to grow cotton for that particular purpose, okay, whether the slavery was justified by the cotton gin, all the other types of slavery was really mowed out, because it was just not advantageous. Anyway, my point is that if you do this research, folks, please let me know. To prove me wrong, I'd be happy to move forward, and I'd be happy to admit I was wrong. Because I would literally go, because I think you're going to find the source documents that will actually help us find the truth. But if I'm wrong, and it's totally wrong, then I'd be happy to admit I'm wrong. But I am asserting that Missouri was inflicted with slavery because of political purposes, nothing to do with the want of the people. Anyway, all right, so let's dive into the Amendment Protection Clause. Right, because I don't think we've gotten into this. So who we leave off with? So let's pick up with the original language that they have. And now they actually insert, instead of it being 4 and 5 clauses, they've actually changed it to 1 and 4. So is Tammy, are you up or is Sean?
I believe I am. Are we starting with Mr. Sherman? Or?
Actually, no, the Amendment Protection Clause ahead of that. Read the new language. Oh. And then we'll go with Mr. Sherman's comment.
I guess I don't know where we're at.
We're
bottom of 462. Ah. It's yellow and blue.
Yep. And it says amendment protection right above it. It's an insert.
Okay. Well, Sean, go ahead, because mine's not the same page as that.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Amendment Protection, Article 5, quote, the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem necessary, on the application of two-thirds of the legislatures of the several states, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part thereof, when the same shall have been ratified by three-fourths at least of the legislatures of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress, provided that no amendment which may be made to prior to the year of 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of Article 1.
Okay, so that was the language that they were now seeing in this new formed Constitution. And so, again, remember that they've already read the Constitution, and now they're nitpicking, or they're making the suggestions. So Mr. Sherman then speaks up, and are you with us, Tammy? This is...
I am.
Okay. Yep. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Sherman expressed his fears that three-fourths of the states might be brought to do things fatal to particular states as abolishing them altogether or depriving them of their equality in the Senate. He thought it reasonable that the provision in favor of the states importing slaves should be extended so as to provide that no state should be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equality in the Senate.
Okay, so he was agreeing with the importation, you know, regulating the importation of slaves. But he also said, hey, we need to protect the sovereignty or the equality of the state in the Senate. So Colonel Mason then adds to this. Go ahead, Sean.
Colonel Mason thought the plan of amending the Constitution exceptionable and dangerous, as the proposing of amendments is in both the modes to depend in the first immediately, and the second ultimately on Congress. No amendments of the proper kind would ever be obtained by the people. If the government should become oppressive, as he verily believed would be the case.
Interesting. So basically, and as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, Mason was against the amendment process, at least the convention. Go ahead with... Actually, let me read Governor Mason, and then you can read Madison, Tammy. Mr. Governor Morris and Mr. Gary moved to amend the articles as to require a convention on application of two-thirds of the states. So, in other words, that language then got embedded into Article 5. Then Mr. Madison said this.
Mr. Madison did not see why Congress would not be as much bound to propose amendments applied for by two-thirds of the states as to call a convention on the like application. He saw no objection, however, against providing for the convention for the purpose of amendments, except only that difficulties might arise as to form, the quorum, etc., which and constitutional regulations ought to be as much as possible avoided. The motion from Mr. Governor Morris and Mr. Gary was agreed to without contest.
Okay. All right, so let's go a little bit further now, because as you can see, they weren't talking about what Sherman had mentioned. It's almost like nobody even addressed it. He suggested that they create a protection for the state sovereignty and the state legislature's suffrage in the U.S. Senate as a part of Article 5. And it was just ignored. So, in the next little segment, just a little bit below on amendment protection, I provide this now highlighted in red instead of yellow. Okay, so Mr. Sherman kicks it off again. Sean.
Mr. Sherman moved to strike out of Article 5 after, quote, legislatures, the words of three-fourths, and so after the word conventions, leaving future conventions to act in this matter, like the present conventions, according to circumstances.
All right. So I think that's what... Now read the next Mr. Sherman in red.
Mr. Sherman moved according to his idea above, expressed to annex to the end of the article a further proviso, quote, that no state without its consent be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Okay, so this was ultimately this move to create that second amendment protection clause of protecting state sovereignty, state legislature sovereignty over their state. Mr. Madison, go ahead, Tammy.
Begin with the special, that part?
Yes.
I'm lost. Okay. Mr. Madison, begin with the special provisos.
Yes.
And every state will insist on them for their boundaries, exports, etc. And then on the motion of Mr. Sherman.
Okay, so at this point, they basically shot down Mr. Sherman's point, right? New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, yes. And then Delaware, yes. And the rest were no's. So it was 3-8. Anyway, so Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out Article 5 altogether. In other words, let's just get rid of the amendments to the Constitution, because if we can't protect the state sovereignty from amendments, then let's not have amendments at all. Right? So that was his next move.
That's kind of a good point.
Kind of a shock. You know, hold on here. We're trying to make a mechanism so that we can, you know, fix deficiencies and problems and so forth. And now he says, let's just get rid of it. So Mr. Beerley seconded the motion, which no, no, yes, yes, no, 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 no. So that didn't fly either. So Mr. Governor Morris then stepped in. And Sean, go ahead, let's try this.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to annex a further proviso, quote, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate, end quote. This motion being dictated by the circulating murmurs of the small states was agreed to without debate, no one opposing it or on the question saying no.
So in other words, he just changed the language a little bit to ensure that no state would lose its suffrage or be deprived of its equal suffrage without their consent. And boom, no contest, put it in. So now we had a second amendment protection clause added or appended to the end of Article 5 following the amendment protection clause of not allowing any amendment to shut down the federal government's ability to shut down the slave trade. Basically. Okay, so Mr. Mason then stated what? Go ahead, Tammy.
Colonel Mason, expressing his discontent at the power given to Congress by a bare majority to pass Navigation Acts, which he said would not only enhance the freight, a consequence he did not so much regard, but would enable a few rich merchants in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston to monopolize the staples of the southern states and reduce their value perhaps 50%. Moved a further proviso that no law in Nature of Navigation Act be passed before the year 1808 without the consent of two-thirds of each branch of the legislature.
Okay, so now he was actually looking that no law would allow this. Technically, this was something that should have been injected into Article 1, Section 9, that the federal government could not make any laws to do that, because that's where it would be. He's not seeking the restriction on an amendment. He's just seeking, because they already have the authority to make navigational laws. He wanted to make sure that they wouldn't allow these types of things to go down this path. And then he says that no law in nature of a Navigation Act be passed before 1808 without the consent. So, in other words, he was trying to create these, and that could have easily, because where's the language for the law of restricting the, help me out here, the restricting the ending of the slave trade to begin in 1808? Where is that? That is in Article 1, Section 9. So I'm not sure if he needed to specify, hey, because they were talking about Article 5. I think he may have confused people to think that he wanted to add that into Article 5. I think that should have possibly been added to create this, you know, this negative, so that they couldn't mess around with navigation laws until after that point. Now, somebody brought it up, and I think it may have been Madison, just in today's session, somebody had brought it up to basically say, hey, we want to make sure that we're not nickel and diming them to death, because they're just going to want to come up and say, well, we want this change, we want this change. And if, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that was Mason himself to say, we don't want to add a whole bunch of these little things. Maybe it was Madison that said, you know, we can easily go down this path of trying to create all these little caveats of not allowing them to do these things. Sherman was the one that said, hey, don't put it in there, and then they can't do it. Anyway, does that all make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So now,
I wish they would have put something in there that says, if it's not in here, you can't do it.
They did. That's the 10th Amendment. Only the powers delegated to the federal government are those things that they can do. In other words, any power not delegated in this Constitution or restricted by the states from it, then are reserved to the people in the states, or the states and the people respectively. The 10th Amendment does say exactly that. So, and Madison points this out. So as we, the last thing we're going to cover is the apportionment. And what we may end up doing.
Time, sir.
Yeah, I know we're out of time completely. We may end up covering the apportionment either tomorrow or the following day. I wanted to do a transition and a summary and kind of talk about, because what I want to do is I'd like to have Tammy involved, because our next recording will probably be with just Sean. And so I want to make sure that the three of us talk about this apportionment. But I think that what we're going to talk about tomorrow will easily lead into the following day to include Tammy, and I know, you know, this being Tammy's favorite show, she'll probably be listening to it, so she'll be apprised. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.